Today is Friday, February 26, 2016. Good afternoon. Welcome, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee will convene at 1:03 p.m. Present, Representative Josephson, Representative Olson, Representative Seaton, and Representative Mike Harker, Vice Chair, my fellow co-chair, Representative Tallarico, and myself, Representative Nayak. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello to Julie from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO. Today we welcome back Derek Meyer and Nico Safos via telephone from Analytica to finish presenting the impact of oil and gas production North Slope assessment. Then Analytica will present impact of House Bill 247 Cook Inlet assessment. If we do not finish with Analytica's presentations today, we'll complete the presentations tomorrow at our 10 o'clock a.m. hearing. Tomorrow's hearing will also include continuation of House Bill 247 Director Ken Apper will present. Welcome back, Mr. Meyer. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and begin. Mr. Safos is on the phone with us as well. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. For the record, Janik Meyer. I'm the chairman of Analytica here as the legislature's consultants employed through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to advise on matters relating to oil and gas, particularly commercialization, fiscal systems, and things like that. To continue yesterday's presentation, we ended up on this slide looking at the question of effectively moving from annual to monthly reconciliation of the tax system in terms of the impact of various credits, particularly the dollar per barrel credit, also for other producers, depending on the other provisions of this bill, things like the small producer tax credit, the net operating loss credit, how all those things interact with the hard gross minimum floor, and the question of that calculation being done effectively on a monthly rather than on an annual basis.
For the record, Representative Johnson has joined us.
Thank you, Mr.
And Representative Parr has joined us. Thank you. Proceed.
So in talking through this yesterday, what we walked through was the question of if one does this calculation on an annual basis, you can see on this slide the sort of top row of that set of numbers. Start with ANS West Coast price, you subtract off transportation, you subtract off your operating and capital costs, you end up with a production tax per barrel. Do the 35% calculation on that, you take away credits that you're eligible for a producer on an incumbent established producer on the North Slope, principally the sliding eight or less dollar per barrel credit. If we looked at this in across the year of 2014, that would have been an $8 per barrel credit. And you end up then with a final amount of tax liability. In this case, based on that annual calculation, $8.70. That's higher than the 4% gross floor, and so that is the production tax per barrel that one is effectively paying. If instead that calculation is done monthly, in a year like 2014, when you had a lot of volatility in the oil price, for almost all of the year, that would still have been a net tax calculation, but in those final 2 months of the year, where the oil price fell to $77 and then $60 a barrel, that instead becomes, the net calculation is less than the 4% binding gross, and the 4% gross kicks in for those 2 months of the year. So even though when one takes the average, it's a pure net tax situation. If one does this on a monthly basis, there are 2 months of gross minimum that kick in, and the net effect is to raise the amount of production tax per barrel a taxpayer is paying, in this case from about $8.70 to $9.30 instead. And when you multiply that, for instance, as a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation by the number of taxable barrels on the North Slope, that's about $100 million in additional tax that would have been taken in essentially by this switch from an annual to a monthly calculation. When one thinks about this, essentially it's the sort of tax hike that happens because the change you're introducing is a sort of heads, either sovereign win, tails, it's a draw situation. If there is no volatility, the two things are the same. The more there is volatility in the oil price, the more this switch works in the sovereign's favour and again in the taxpayer's disadvantage. The other thing that's worth pointing out is what this means is because the calculation is being done each month, it means each month you really need to understand as a taxpayer what your costs are for that month, and you're trying to do that entire calculation. It's almost as if you're trying to file your tax return not annually but monthly. Some of that will be trued up at the end of the year, but for instance you need to be very certain in this circumstance that you're not understating what your costs were for the month, because the way the language is written, if it turns out at the end of the year your costs were higher, the sum of your total can't be higher than the sum of your monthlies, and that those credits are lost to you forever, essentially.
And I just apologies, I just wanted to be in the queue to have a question when he's done presenting.
Okay.
It's also worth pointing out this analysis, and I think a lot of the discussion to date around this is focused on the sort of sliding $8 a barrel credit in the world of the sort of large incumbent oil producer. It's worth remembering that particularly in conjunction with some of the other provisions in this bill, which is to say the floor hardening not just for incumbent producers but also for new producers around making the floor binding on GVR eligible oil, for instance, and binding through meaning that the net operating loss credit, the small producer credit, those sorts of things can't be taken away from the floor, also means that this has a substantial impact on those companies as well.
And thank you. Is my understanding that the numbers we're looking at here are the actual numbers as reported for 2014?
Representative Hawker, that's broadly speaking correct. It's a very high-level approximation that essentially treats the North Slope as if it were one uniform taxpayer. The cost numbers are also fiscal year 2014, whereas of course the tax year is a calendar year one, so there's not a perfect match there, but yes, those are, to the extent that one can create a reasonably accurate picture through back of the envelope high level numbers versus individual taxpayer numbers, those are actual numbers.
If I may continue. And you come up with an additional $100 million liability, which is basically the number that Tax Director Alper said that industry denied the state through this mechanism. Can you explain costs? Can you explain to me how and why the operating costs and the capital expense costs somehow managed to be the same number for every single month?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, in this case, this is simply taking the annual 2014 numbers and spreading them in even proportion across the year. In practice, as a taxpayer, there would be variation there, and one of the difficulties, I think, as a taxpayer is if this is the monthly calculation you need to do, you need to understand month by month what those are, and actually you're probably going to want to be careful to on the conservative side and overstate them, and then worry about dealing with that overstatement at true-up, rather than be worried about understating them, in which case the credits that you potentially forewent because you were interacting with the floor, you can never ever get back.
I'm sorry, I don't think that was quite where I was going. Don't we require in the calculation the payers use basically a monthly estimate based on a monthly portion of what they estimate their annual expenses to be? So aren't you really mirroring the way the tax calculation actually works in statute?
Representative Hawkins, to the chair, if you're saying that the calculation is supposed to be take the annual estimate and divide it by 12?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
So the numbers that we see on a monthly basis here do not reflect the amount that was actually being paid by the industry in that month?
Representative Hawkins, to the chair, the costs that are here are simply revenue sources, handbook costs spread evenly across the year. They're not actual data.
I'll repeat my question. I mean, if you don't know, I'll ask someone else, but is that not the way the calculation is done by within state statute?
My understanding is it is, but I don't profess
okay,
to
I'll wait till I get somebody else. Thank you. I have Mr. Alper nodding, but I'm going to miss my whole point because I can't validate it here, so thank you.
Can I ask for clarification?
Representative Josephson?
Mr. Mayor, I,
through the chair, I guess I could ask Mr. Hawker, are you saying that if the OPEX and CAPEX actually reflected what was really going on in the month, that the tax in the far or second of the right column would be different? Is that?
That's exactly the point. It would be substantially different.
Okay.
But I'm not the one giving the presentation, so.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Are the representative here and is present?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that that's a great point to raise in terms of looking at that. Although, I guess because the ANS West Coast price is different on a month-to-month basis, I mean, at least this illustrates some of the variation as a function of the price, you know, the per barrel price there, but not a true reflection of OPEX and CAPEX. Is that true?
The point we made in all of this is that there are various elements of intra-year volatility in the system. Whether price is a principal one of those, depending on the nature of the tax calculation being performed, costs are certainly one of those. A big part of the reason for doing an annual calculation is to reduce that volatility and take, in the same way as for any of us who are individual income taxpayers, we take our entire income over the year rather than what we earned in any given week or month. We remove some of that volatility in performing a reasonable calculation. The aim of this essentially is saying, rather than having that volatility smoothing of an annual calculation, is saying month by month we assess how this works, and that can only work in the sovereign's favor. Can only ever be a tax hike that is a tax hike in the event of price volatility, essentially. One of the other issues that's raised in the bill is this question of how the gross value reduction for new oil interacts with the net operating loss credit. And this is one area where I think the administration has actually raised quite an important and valid point that I think is useful to debate. One of the things I said in giving my summary of some of the key thinking and impetus in Senate Bill 21 was about saying where ACES has had a wildly varying rate of support for government spending. It could be 45%, it could be close to or even over, in some cases 100%. That could vary very wildly, again, month by month, depending on prices and costs and all the rest. A big part of Senate Bill 21 was to say we're going to have a uniform 35% support for government spending in all circumstances. One of the things that the impact, and I talked yesterday about the reason for the gross value reduction as being a way of reducing the effective tax rate that new oil pays by effectively artificially lowering the way the tax system treats the value of the wellhead in order to lower the tax rate. One of the impacts of that is because everything in the calculation flows on from that, that also then affects the way the net operating loss is assessed. To understand how that works, it's worth looking through this calculation. So in the Senate Bill 21 with gross value reduction, you can see we start, for instance, in a $30 a barrel world. With that price, we take off $10 for transport. We take off, we end up with a gross value at the point of production before factoring in the gross value reduction of $10. In this case, sorry, of $20. I can get my pointer to work. After the gross value reduction, however, we're taking off an extra 20% of that, so we are at 16 instead of the 20. We then take out our OPEX and CAPEX, and the production value that falls out the end is a $20 loss. Of course, had we not had the gross value reduction, that would have been a $16 loss. That the actual loss of the wellhead essentially is a $16 loss. With the gross value reduction in there, what the tax system recognizes is a $20 loss. That's important at higher prices and indeed at all prices in reducing the effective tax rate. But because the net operating loss credit, which purpose of which was to say 35% support government spending at all prices, is not looking at what was your actual loss. The way it's written is simply looking at what was your production tax value per barrel, effectively. The effect is to overstate the loss, and in this case, what you see, therefore, is instead of a credit of 35% of the actual production tax value, it's in this case 44% of that actual number, because it's based on the number after the gross value reduction has been applied.
Oh, sorry. Falling asleep. Good. Representative Tarr.
Mr. Chairman, and I suppose I could wait, but I just, I don't know if Representative Hawker plans on trying to get back to the points on the previous slide. Okay. I guess I'll wait, but I do want to come back to that and just ask a couple of questions about scenarios where the CapEx spending is less in that single month, just running some quick numbers. But I'll hold off on that till we get through the end. We can come back.
Okay.
If there are questions on this slide, otherwise I will continue to the next.
Representative Hawker?
No, I'm good, thanks.
Okay. So, I guess there are two things to say about that. One is, I do think that in setting the policy direction that was set under SB 21, the aim was to have a uniform 35% support of government spending in all circumstances. On the other hand, I think it's also very clear that a number of investments have been made under the tax system, the tax regime as it currently stands, over the intervening time between when SB 21 was enacted and now. And, you know, any change such as this seriously impacts those investments. And so I think one can look at this and think this might actually be a substantive matter of policy that one wants to come back and address, thinking the question of how one addresses that and the timing and how that applies and when that applies, I think then becomes critical, because there are numerous investments that have been made that are spending that is actually happening today as we speak, that were made under certain assumptions, and that is those assumptions including modelling this exactly as it was, and those investments are impacted by any change like this. So it's one thing to look at this and ask the question, was this what was intended, and should this at some point change? And then another, I think, to think about if that should change, how that should be enacted, what the applicable time frame is, who is impacted when. I think those are all very important considerations, given that any change to this does actually impact substantially the economics of ongoing investment.
Mr. Chairman?
This question was asked of you before, but could we have it in this example, could we create it where the credit of 35 now stays with projects that are in play? And anything in any projects that are in the future, they would be under a different tax regime, like 247?
Representative Harris, through the chair, there are certainly ways of achieving exactly that. When I think about even existing statute, for instance, there are currently small producers on the North Slope that continue to receive a small producer tax credit, though that is not open to new entrants. So there are certainly ways of achieving that sort of effect, yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Sheaton.
Thank you. Do you have any indication from when we were discussing SB 21 that anyone that was projecting a project was counting on not getting 35% and was counting on being able to somehow leverage more than that?
Representative for the chair, I think it's an excellent question. Let me answer it this way, which is, when I was first made aware of this issue, I was shocked and surprised, because I thought we were all very clear that we intended 35%. When I went back to my own models and the way those models actually produced exactly the regime as it exists, which is in effect a higher level of support for government spending, which is to say, when you tweak the gross value at the point of production, the rest of this falls out. And it's not to say that trying to think of the best way to articulate this. The oversight is to see that when you tweak this, that comes out. Not that it's not a sort of legislative loophole or a strange bit of drafting. It's that it's a complicated system, and when you make one change up here, it affects numerous things further below. So in that sense, anyone, whether this was me or the administration's consultants or, you know, building models at the time, or anyone assessing an investment in the meantime, you assemble in your model the pieces of the system and create those settings, and you look at the economics that flow out as a result, and you assess, in the case of a company assessing a project, you assess things based on what you see, right? You're not necessarily there asking, oh, as I assess my economics, what's the implicit level of government support for spending, and is that what the legislature intended, I think is the answer to that. So yes, I firmly believe that anyone assessing their economics on a project they took sanction on was doing it on the system that existed, not necessarily on the basis of legislative intent.
For the record, Representative Ortiz has joined us, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess if somebody had spotted this way, and none of the consultants that were advising us at the time spotted this, and no one testifying on the projects that were under development spotted this, that if somebody did spot this and figured, well, maybe they could just not address it or could tweak it in and not understand our discussions, that I don't think they would be surprised if we came back and assessed the system that we thought we were passing at the time. So I guess that's just more of a comment than, you know, when you talk about stability in a regime, I'm not saying that anybody did understand. I think that the companies, when they were talking to us about the system, were being forthright and telling us what they thought it did, what support was in government take. So I'm not suggesting that anybody knew about it at the time. So I just...
And Representative Sin, through the chair, more than that, I would suggest, you know, when a company is evaluating a project to take final investment decision, there are a lot of things they're looking at, right? Whether that's things like net present value and internal rate of return, whether that's the long-term cash flow that's generated, what various risked and unrisked scenarios are. I would be very surprised if among those metrics were what is the implicit rate of government support for spending. And in that case, in that sense, I would be very surprised for any company assessing their system to look at this and think, oh, wait a second, there's something a bit odd here. That makes sense.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of thoughts through the chair, Mr. Mayor. One of them is we heard someone from the current administration who worked for the prior administration who said that the prior administration did identify this problem, that is the problem of going under, not only under a tax rate of 4%, but under a 0% effective tax. And it strikes me that a couple things. First, everyone that I speak to says we're making slightly more revenue now than under the prior regime. That needs to be said. Mm-hmm. And second, that perhaps what I'm sensing both from your testimony and given that the prior administration understood this potential problem is that no one foresaw this level of price. That was the central sort of fact that was not discussed.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, a few points on that if I can. First is to say it's important to distinguish the point being made on this slide isn't about the gross floor and whether or not one can go below that or not. I think that was quite a deliberate decision to say that for the reasons we discussed yesterday, because gross taxes are effectively distorting on investment, that one didn't want that 4% floor to be binding on new production, right? And that was a deliberate and thought through decision to say we want it to be binding on the legacy thing because that's where we really need to protect the revenue for the state, but on new investment we want to minimize the distorting impact, and so for that reason that floor won't be binding in the same way as it is on the legacy fields. I think that was a deliberate policy decision.
Yes.
I would also say, you know, for instance, there are a few places in this slide, whether a price decks presented in terms of analysis of things like government takeover of a range of prices. In the deck as I presented in here, that goes from $40 a barrel up to, I think, $150, $160. That's the same range, for instance, that all of the analysis that I presented back in 2013 used. It doesn't go below 40 because, frankly, the math doesn't really work below $40 a barrel, because at that point there is no divisible income to split, and metrics like government take don't mean anything because they're all infinite. You know, I remember sitting here at this exact table almost exactly 3 years ago now, as the initial discussions around SB 21 were starting, and being asked at the time to prepare several slides by the then chairman of the Resources Committee around what did PFC Energy, the company I worked for then, see as the short-term and long-term likely floor price for ANS West Coast crude. And I gave several slides on that, talking through what we saw as the scenario, and what we talked through was we saw unprecedented growth in North American onshore production. We saw a situation where OPEC and Saudi Arabia were increasingly unable to manage the market in the way they had in the past, where you had rising production from Iraq, where the question of what happened with Iran was unknown, and that all of these things combined with a weak global outlook meant that we saw more risks to the downside than the upside. And when asked what a reasonable floor price might be, we said in the short run we could see scenarios of strong oversupply and failure of management by OPEC, which could reduce it down to $30 a barrel, and that in the long run that there would be a strong supply response, particularly from North America, for that to happen. And in the long run, somewhere in the $50 to $70 range was where we saw the long-term floor price. So, you know, a big part of the reason I would say for some of the testimony I gave back then was to say so much of the debate at those times focused on when the price is $140, $150 a barrel, how much are we giving away and should we be taking more? And I think the testimony I gave then was to say, remember, the commodity business is cyclical. Remember that times are high now, but there will be low times as well. And more than anything else, you need a system that is capable of protecting the state's interests in those times, and that if you have to fight about what are you giving away at $150 a barrel, that's a really nice problem to have. Now, as we're at the bottom of the cycle, I would say, you know, remember, again, take that long-term view. This is a cyclical business, and the problem now is how do you maintain ongoing investment even when times are rough? And yes, one needs to protect the state's interest. Yes, one needs to do what one can to plug a very, very difficult fiscal hole. But if one does that at the expense of changes in fiscal terms that say to investors, you know, sorry, this isn't the stable jurisdiction you were hoping for, that potentially has a long-term cost that one needs to think seriously about.
Thank you. One other thing, through the chair, on a point Representative Herron addressed. If we were to have some sort of a defined time for when HB 247's reforms would take effect, wouldn't even a leasehold investor, someone who made a bid on a lease, there were bids last November, because I was there in the room with Representative Tarr when they were bidding, couldn't they say, geez, that, you know, we expected X regime and now you're giving us Y regime? Even though the lease itself is the infancy of their entire project, right? It's the birth of the project. How it strikes me that the adjustment might not be made for a decade.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, it depends very greatly on the specific nature of the change you're trying to make, right, as to who it impacts and how, and what the time frame that works through the system is. If the change one is making is primarily around credits, for instance, in many circumstances, you know, the capital intensive nature of an investment is in those early years of, you know, constructing facilities, drilling wells, etc., and that tails off at some point, and the impact is much more important in those early years than it is later on. If the change one is making has to do with the overall rate of tax, or the overall rate of tax in low price environments and all the rest, those are changes that hurt whenever in time they're made. And in that sense, again, I come back to the question of changes that are fundamental questions of policy and wanting to set a sustainable fiscal system that is sustainable for all parties across a wide range of prices versus changes that are this year, how do we get a little bit more revenue? And I think those are very, very different questions that have very different impacts on the question of how stable the fiscal system in Alaska is seen as being.
Thank you.
Representative Harker.
Janik, this question of the 35% net operating loss credit carry, net operating loss credit carry forward. You know, the statute very, very clearly states, as we wrote it, a producer or explorer may elect to take a tax credit in the amount of 35% of a carry forward annual loss. That's 4355.023B. With something that clear in statute, I just, again, kind of, as you've worked with various regimes and the expectations of both the payors and the payees of these sort of things, is it really the words that matter here? Or, you know, as we talk about, well, maybe the intent wasn't quite that, but what's industry really relying on, our intent or the actual letter in the statute? You know, and I guess it kind of gets back to when we have, no matter what we have written, and does not both we and industry have a reasonable expectation that they will comply with the law as it's written?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, absolutely. Industry takes the statute and turns that into a model and assesses the performance of any investment they seek to make against what their model says. When one does that, it's easy to assemble that model without seeing that the impact of the statute as it is written is that that effectively, although the statute says 35% of a carried forward annual loss, when you think about how that annual loss is defined, it turns out it's defined based on production tax value, and that in turn is defined based on the gross value reduction. And it's...
But I'm getting to... Yes, I understand that, you know, there is, at these lower prices, there is a problematic value translation between a net operating loss and the value of the credit carry forward. But, again... Is it from a, if you're the guys that we passed the law, we said go make decisions based on it. Any way we look at it, even if we think we're fixing something, a mistake we made, from the standpoint of the people that we're asking to rely on our statute, isn't it still a tax increase?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, absolutely it is, without question.
Thank you.
Okay.
To briefly follow up, Representative Hawker, through the chair, that is essentially the core of my point as to why one needs to balance two things very carefully, which is, on the one hand, the policy point about what one would like the system to be and what one intended the system to be, and the second point, which is, but industry has made investment decisions based on the system as it is, not as it might be in an ideal world, and any changes have substantial impact, and one needs to think very carefully about that.
And thank you. And wouldn't prospectively, and only prospectively, wouldn't an elegant fix for this be something as simple, rather than the complex approach I think that's been offered up in the bill, which has its own, essentially restructures the system, the tax system we're dealing with, but something that more, you know, is more targeted and simply, instead of saying we guarantee, you know, the 35% carry forward, simply state something like, you know, we take the amount, you know, the value of the net operating loss in a given year is translated into a carry forward credit using the marginal tax rate of the taxpayer. And then we have an equal translation of value, and you don't get this circumstance that you're talking about here where you get a tax credit that arguably has a greater value than the deduction was in the year it was incurred.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I haven't thought through the question of statutory language and ways of implementing that change, but I'm very happy to do so and come back with some thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Proceed.
To come now to one of the biggest proposed changes in House Bill 247 is, of course, the hardening of the gross floor. We talked through yesterday the fact that under ACES, the capital credit calculation was applied after the comparison between the net and the gross systems, and therefore was effectively non-binding in most circumstances. You can see that on this chart, where, for instance, we look at the effective production tax rate, the chart on the left, the yellow line is what that was under ACES, and at higher prices, that was substantially higher than under SB21. At this price deck, they're relatively close. The difference, of course, is that under SB21, this comes to a peak of about 35% at the highest ranges, around $150, which aren't shown here on this chart because the aim is to make the lower end here legible. ACES, of course, went on up and up to much higher levels at those high prices. But in this range here that we're talking about, the key difference is, of course, the effective tax rate under ACES kept coming down and eventually came down to zero. Under SB21, that hardening of the floor essentially meant it could come down to about a 10% effective tax rate for legacy producers, and then it bottomed out and started rising, and once you get to the $60 range, it suddenly turns into this hockey stick, where it goes up and very quickly, asymptotically, approaches infinity. And that comes back to the point that we were discussing yesterday about the nature of gross taxes, and the fact that, you know, as the amount of net value that you have in the barrel gets smaller and smaller, anything that is a fixed amount of the total value takes up a steadily larger portion of that until it takes up all of it, and then once it takes up all of it, the measure of an effective tax rate or effective government take becomes meaningless because it's all essentially infinite. And you can see, you know, the price level at which that happens versus the price levels where we are at the moment. And I think that's really, really, really an important point for people to understand. I've heard far too many people talk about, well, you know, the effective rate, for instance, of production tax comes down and the producers are only paying a 4% rate at the moment. It's 4% of gross, and as a share of the net, it comes down from 35% down to around 10%, and then it very quickly skyrockets up towards infinity. The effect of House Bill 247, particularly on incumbent producers, we'll talk over the coming slides about the impact on new developments and particularly new developments by new companies. But the impact here obviously is twofold. On the right-hand side, rather than look at this in terms of effective production tax rate, this is simply in terms of absolute dollars per taxable barrel. You can see that there's a difference here in the sort of $40 range, where at some point there is literally no net value left at all, and in fact the producer has a net operating loss. At the moment, the idea is that net operating loss can then take one down below the floor. Mm-hmm. Again, I think, you know, if one thinks back to the statute, the way the statute was written, it's very clear that these were specific provisions, right? The aim of the hard floor under the dollar per barrel credit was to say we're concerned that, you know, at the lowest prices we want to protect some of the state's revenue, but we're also mindful that gross taxes make life very difficult for the industry when prices are low, precisely because they very quickly take everything and then more than everything. And so once you're actually in an environment that you have a net operating loss, we're not sure that we, you know, there's still the regressive royalty that's taking everything or more than everything. We're not sure in that environment that we should be adding to it with 4% of the gross, and so maybe that net operating loss credit should be able to take you down to zero. The question of changing that is obviously a policy question about, again, balancing protecting the state at the low end versus what the state takes at the high end, and what a sustainable and competitive regime looks like in how it balances those things.
Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to understand, when you say goes to zero, you know, and I guess there's sort of two different scenarios. I mean, one would just be zero and it'd be within that calendar year, but then the more problematic thing is we're experiencing is, you know, what's carried forward into the next, so we're 100 plus. And I was trying to do research to figure out, you know, we're always looking at our overall competitiveness and how we compare to other jurisdictions, and we're just trying to find other examples of a situation where it goes, you know, 100% plus. And I'm just wondering, you know, with your knowledge of other tax regimes, if you know of other locations where this, you know, happens, or how in other circumstances do they control it? So it goes to zero. And so the recognition is, in this low price environment, there is no profit, you know, so basically no tax. But are other people, in addition to that, you know, going beyond then, so that you're getting more than, you know, the 100% plus?
Representative Chaffer, the chair, it's an excellent question. Certainly there are plenty of tax systems I can think of that enable you to carry forward losses. That's a standard feature of a great many tax systems. That's true of federal income tax, for instance. It's the next thing that comes to my mind, for instance, is the net profit-based, cash flow-based production tax that exists in Australia, which on the one hand, I think we were talking about this a bit yesterday, has some protection for the sovereign by saying outflows, namely the sorts of things that here in Alaska are credits, are not paid out, they're carried forward against future liability. But that means that all negative tax items essentially are carried forward. So that the carry forward is not unusual in that sense. And again, I think the thing one has to balance against all those, right, is remembering that unlike many places, Alaska has the fixed royalty that is already taking a substantial piece of the pie. In fact, a zero or negative pie is taking a substantial and positive piece of in those environments. So it's,
Follow up, Mr. Chairman? And in the operating loss credits, I mean, how would we compare, sort of the cash credits versus just putting against a future tax liability? Because I think what's been shown to be kind of problematic for us was then having the actual expenditure, because if you do it in the cash basis, right, then you actually have to give money out. Versus, I think that would give us more protection if it were only ever allowed to be used against future tax liability, and that's part of what's contemplated here.
Representative Chaffrey, the chair, what's contemplated in House Bill 247 is not sort of ending the cash payout of credits at the moment. That cash payout only happens to companies with less than 50,000 barrels a day of production. House Bill 247 would sort of put some additional restrictions on it, including it doesn't happen to companies with more than, I think, $10 billion in revenues.
Right.
And then it puts a cap on the amount that any given company can claim. And some of the next slides actually talk about the impact of that. I do think that there is a strong case from, again, the sovereign protecting itself to say that some sort of cap makes sense at some point. The question of whether it should be $25 million and what time frame it applies over, I think, is a much more difficult question, because that has some very serious impacts, including very serious impacts on investments that are being made at the moment. In the next couple of slides, I'll talk that through, so I might move on to that if that works.
Representative Hacker?
No, sir. No, sir.
Oh, okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as we go through here, where we are experiencing our tax regime across the state, but where royalties are private royalties or federal royalties, where we don't where we don't get anything from those offshore, what does the tax regime look like in those field cases where we're not getting a royalty, and but we're getting the liability under this and rolling forward?
Representative Sitton, through the chair, I think you raise a very valid point. I haven't done a lot of modeling on that specific question, and I think it merits serious analysis, because I can certainly see a lot of cases where, particularly, for instance, new investment projects with everything that the gross value reduction and those other things that apply there provide. One can certainly see that if one had a sustained period of low prices, that the value proposition to the state specifically might be a lot less than it is in places where the state also has the royalty. And I think that's a very legitimate concern that I would want to get into some more detail on before offering some detailed advice about, if I could.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Proshi.
So the next question we wanted to address is, how do some of these changes impact a new field development? And in this case, we were essentially talking about something that qualifies for the gross value reduction new oil regime under SB 21. So to do that, we sort of created what we think is a good hypothetical sort of sample investment. It's about what would cumulatively recover about 80 million barrels of oil, about peaking at about 20,000 barrels a day in production. Total capital spend of about $1.3 billion, average annual operating cost of about $15 a barrel. 30 wells, 20 producers, 10 injectors, drilled over a course of 8 years. And we sort of, when we go about this sort of analysis, we start with what we think is a reasonable well cost, a well type curve, drilling profile, cost for facilities, and try to build it up from that granular level. And I think the reason we try to do that will become even more clear when we get into some of the Cook Inlet slides, where the ability to get down to that level becomes very important in assessing some of the project economics. But the idea here, as you can see, is you have about sort of the in the cash flow chart, those bright blue bars on the left, harder to see on the screen, so I'll circle them with a pointer, the process of facilities development. So you're spending, before you drill a single well, really, you're sort of spending about $400 million, right, on a gravel pad, if we're talking about a North Slope development, on pipelines to facilities, all the rest. At some point, let's say, in this model, year three, you then get to drilling, and you see the sort of Drillex start to occur here and continue for several years as you start drilling these wells. You're drilling a lot of wells up front to get your production up, and then once you've got it up, you're drilling at a lower rate for a number of years further to sort of sustain some sort of plateau level of production. And you can see the sort of cash flow that then occurs, where in these early years the investor is substantially negative, takes a good many years to get back to sort of zero, and at this point then is when the project is actually cash flow positive and generating value. And you can see there is a substantial, there's a corresponding difference in the profile of government take over the course of time as a result. In these early years, government take is effectively negative, and that's the impact of the credits being paid out, in this case being effectively being paid out as cash, as a net operating loss reimbursed credit. We have these early years where costs are high and revenues are low, and probably the only thing being paid is royalty. And then these later years where there's really just some ongoing sustaining drilling happening, and so, well, ongoing sustaining drilling happening here, and then from this point on, the main costs are simply operating costs, and there is therefore a lot more value. And this is where, the bulk of the production tax is actually harvested in that sense, right? So I think it's really useful in thinking through these debates to think through not just sort of the figures that sometimes get thrown around, well, what if we assume in any given year this amount of CapEx and this amount of OpEx, what does that mean, and under a given regime, is tax paid or not? But remember that under almost any regime, there are times when tax is not paid, or in this case, where in fact it's negative, and there are times when it's paid later in the tail, and thinking through the time profile of that is really important in understanding the impact of all these sorts of things. So in looking at that model and the results of that model, the first thing I wanted to focus on is that for any new investment, very clearly to me, the question that Representative Tarr raised a moment ago of caps on the reimbursed capital, the reimbursed net operating loss credit, have a huge impact on, in particular, any investment that is being made at the moment. So the chart on the left here is showing cumulative cash flow. So effectively, if we go back to what I just showed on slide 16, if we take that after-tax cash flow line, right, the dotted black, which is the cash that the producer receives, so the idea here, right, is the green is the gross revenue that's coming in, the various shades of blue and purple are the costs, the red is the government take. If we net all these things out, we have that line of cash flow. If we look at that instead on a cumulative basis, what that tells you is how much do I need to spend before this thing becomes self-financing, right? In this case, up until about 2018, I'm spending. 2018 is when, I've had probably in this case had maybe a year of production, and the revenue that I'm getting from that production is starting to exceed the costs that I have in my ongoing drilling, and that cumulative cash flow curve starts to turn around, right? So if I'm a company, an investor contemplating whether or not I'm going to go ahead and sanction a project, one of the first things I'm looking to do is understand the capital structure that's going to underpin this thing and how it's going to be financed, what I can afford, all of those things, right? And so I'm assessing what's going to be a more than $1 billion investment, in this case, $1.3 billion in total spend, right? But I don't actually need to have $1.3 billion in total spend ready in the bank to make this happen. Because when I look at this, I've modeled the cumulative cash flow, and what I can see here is in this fixed black line, which is based on the system as it exists at the moment without a capped annual credit. All I need to be able to cover is that $300 million in total outflow before this thing becomes self-financing, right? After I spent $300 million, the remaining billion is going to cover itself, right? Because from that point forward, I'm going to have production, I'm going to have positive cash flow, and actually my cumulative cash out is going to switch around and start to come back up, right? So when I'm looking at how much equity do I need, how much debt do I need, I'm not looking at how do I finance $1.3 billion, I'm looking at how do I finance $300 million, right? And that's a very, very big difference. So the big impact there of the credits, right? Because they effectively act to reduce that very strongly. The heavier dashed line is to say, if one were not, didn't have any other projects, if one were a company for whom this was the only project that was being built, and therefore one could claim reimbursable credits but only to a maximum of $25 million per year, what would that look like? And essentially that says, well, instead of $300 million in total outlay until I become cash flow positive, instead here I'm at a bit over $400 million, maybe $420, $25 odd, right? So already there's a whole bunch of additional capital that I need to come up with. And you can imagine, right, it's one thing if we're at the start now assessing this and can take that into account as we figure out what this investment looks like and how we finance it. It's another thing if I'm a year or two into my spend, I have already told my equity investors, you know, I've made the case to them as to what they're putting in and what sort of return they're going to get. I've been to the bank, I know what line of credit I have, and suddenly I need to come back to all these people and say, oh, sorry guys, the picture suddenly changed, I need $100 million more than I thought I needed. That's a very difficult situation to be in, right? It's even more difficult if you're a producer that already has, let's say, another producing asset, right? And either because it's the low price environment or because you have ongoing drilling, right? You haven't yet finished all of your either drilling in your ramp-up phase or you're drilling to maintain your production plateau, you still have substantial costs. You may be already claiming a net operating loss, right? So if there's a $25 million cap per company, you may already be up against that cap on your other producing field, in which case effectively the cap is zero for your new one, right? And so in that case, we could be talking about going from $300 million in capital needed to make this thing work to over $500 million in capital to make this thing work. So, right, that's a 50% increase in the capital base required, which again, very, very difficult conversation to have when you're halfway through the spend and you need to come back to your equity investors and say, I said we needed, say, $150 million. We wanted to be 50-50 debt equity. I needed $150 million in equity capital to make this thing work. Suddenly, actually, I need $250 million. All right? And, oh, by the way, also the internal rate of return on this project is much worse than I thought it was because I did the numbers over the under the previous regime, and now that this is in place, things look very different. Right? You can see why, yes, concern over capping credits is a very, very valid one and something that needs to be thought about and addressed. But there's also a potentially really chilling impact of making a change like this and doing it immediately and the impact that it has both on the ability of investments to occur and particularly on ones that have already been sanctioned and are already ongoing, what it looks like to those folks.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, one thing that I'm struggling with and you know, I'm fairly new to this game in terms of trying to understand the industry and I have every opportunity to do it. Everyone in the legislature is very helpful to me. You're helpful to me. This slide is very meaningful to me. But one of the things that really struck me about this is whether, and I don't know how anyone could model this, but I recall reading, perhaps it was Petroleum News, it was a year or more ago, that if everything went well on the North Slope and every project played out just the way it would and every permit from the federal government was received, perhaps there was an opportunity for 100,000 barrels collectively. Meanwhile, the supergiants are less and less supergiants. And so I guess my question is, When I hear about a field, and this first struck me with Pioneer's Ugarit, great people, now under a different company, But I remember when I first met with him, they said, we've got this island offshore, we're drilling 6,000 barrels a day. And I remember thinking, I'm used to 2.1 million barrels a day. And so I guess my point is, I'm trying to figure out, what am I investing in? Because the industry, excuse me, our department says, by 2022, we're going to have 350,000 barrels. So that's another factor for me is, through no fault of anybody, it's just geology, we're just not producing as much oil. And so what am I investing in? And how can I measure the net value of that to the people while I measure what you've got here on slide 17? Does that make any sense?
It does. Representative Josephson, I'd say more than anything else, you know, what you're investing in is a series of projects that each one may be small, maybe it's only, as you say, 6,000, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 barrels a day in initial production, but you know, each of these is a wedge, and collectively a wedge that, you know, if you just look at the Department of Revenue forecasts on North Slope production over the next 4 or 5 years versus what they were a few years ago, it's a striking flattening of the curve, at least for the next several years, right? And the only way in which that flattening continues to occur is if a series of those projects keeps coming in, and if each one is another incremental wedge that takes you from a 6% annual decline to a 2% annual decline to no decline, and you know, in a world of higher prices and higher investment, might even ideally see things turning the other way. But those things require a lot of the right things, in particular the right price environment, as well as fiscal regime and all the rest to come together.
Okay. Over to Senator Parker.
And thank you. Janik, on this topic of the refundability of credits here, as you point out, it's simply a matter of shifting the capital requirement burden from the state providing investment capital to the private sector having to provide its own investment capital. But couldn't there, if, and again, I want to emphasize, if applied completely proactively, you know, so that we're not stepping into a decision somebody made along the way and suddenly pulling the rug out from under them, which we've been doing lately, not at all taking that off the table, but couldn't restrict, you know, again, limiting the refundability of credits, couldn't that also have a really desirable outcome? Like, we look at, you know, one of the concerns we've had with some of the investors in the Cook Inlet who have not succeeded well. They're, you know, undercapitalized. They left the state. They hung bad paper on everybody. And then a bankruptcy court came in and made the paper even worse. Wouldn't restricting the refundability potentially have the advantage of encouraging, or at least it would result in having stronger, more capitalized, higher qualified investors rather than those that, quite frankly, probably shouldn't be here? And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the state supporting the bad debt industry. Couldn't we actually achieve a good and desirable outcome by restricting the refundability of these credits?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, it's an excellent question. Certainly, when I look at both the Slope and in particular the Cook Inlet, I think there's no question that both basins have been in a sort of precisely the process of evolution that you see in all mature basins, right, where you had a series of large established players for whom this becomes a less material region, in many cases exit, and new players come in, right? And I think the combination of that basic dynamic with very generous and frequently refunded credits has meant that some of the, not by any means all of the players, but that some of the players who have come in have been much more thinly capitalized than they might have been otherwise, because they were able to be, because credits so dramatically reduced the capital requirements that were there. I would also, and in that sense, there are many cases in which refundable credits have meant that people who otherwise need additional working interest partners have been able to get away without having them. Mm-hmm. I think that, in addition, there's a serious question of the sustainability of the refundable credits in numerous environments, right? I think the nightmare scenario from the state's perspective is one where we're not necessarily in a price environment that's as low as we are today, because there is some degree of self-correction here, right, which is when we're in a price environment as low as we are today, not a lot of new stuff is getting sanctioned. But if we're back above $50 and in an environment where prices have come down, you can see a lot of cases where, you know, imagine, and there are places one can think of today where this might be the case, right, that a new Kuparik-sized field had been discovered. And you think about the sheer amount of capital required to develop a resource of that size. And if you think about if the people doing that were all eligible for 35% refundable net operating loss credit, that's a potentially very, very large outflow to the state. And I think everyone should be worried about that scenario. I also think that in any system, having clear rules is always essential, right? The nightmare scenario would be to say there are no clear rules on refundability, but we've already seen last year that there is a degree of executive discretion to try to limit the outflow, right? And that's the worst possible case, because there's all this uncertainty of, well, under statute, the credit's here and it's refundable, but we don't know in practice on any given case whether it's going to exist or not. And I think that is the scenario in which all of us should want to avoid. So having clear rules where the state has looked at this and said, we know that there are constraints on our ability to fund this program, and because there are clear constraints, we want to set those rules and set them clearly, I think is in absolutely everyone's interest. It may be that 25 million, you know, is... I can see lots of reasons why refundable credits provide value in enabling investments that might not otherwise go ahead. And I can think of examples right now of companies that are not thinly capitalized, that have solid backing, but for whom the combination of the lower capital requirements and the higher rate of return that you get because of that make a big difference in enabling a project to be sanctioned, right? And so I think there is, other than the question of simply protecting people who've already made an investment, I think there is a serious question as to whether 25 million is the right number, whether that should be higher, whether that could be higher and still protect the state from some of the worst possibilities that could be outcomes. But certainly I think a system that makes it clear what the limit on the state's exposure is very desirable, yes.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could kind of follow up on this one with the flip side of this, which is, you know, and when I prefaced that previous question, I wanted to completely set aside that if we did anything and make a change like this, why it was so important that it be prospective, yeah, and not affecting your decisions that are already made. I mean, you know, and just wondering if, you know, what, as you counsel us, how strongly you would counsel us to be careful there, because it's a, I guess I look back at last year, you know, we passed our budgets, we made the commitment for this capital to these entities. And if you passed a budget, quite frankly, you know, the governor introduced three separate budgets that included the reimbursement for those reimbursable credits. And then when they got vetoed without any warning, you know, it literally, basically all the investment, a significant amount of investment capital that was committed to this state went away. And I think you just used the word projects that might not otherwise occur. So I guess, you know, my next question, where's the balance here between knowing that if we just pull the rug out from under people, you know, they've made a lot of decisions and all of a sudden those projects don't occur, but should they have occurred? Should they not have occurred? You know, where do we find, how do we approach finding this balance of what, again, without pulling the rug out from under them like we did last year, which literally, you know, stopped projects dead, and frankly, I think it almost came, if it didn't, bankrupt a couple companies, and then knowing that we've actually offered, you know, and how do we make that transition? How would we smooth our way through it?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, certainly I think it would be quite reasonable to say that, you know, moving forward, one wanted to place a series of additional restrictions on eligibility for a refunded credit. And that wouldn't necessarily have to be purely through a cap per company, or if it were a cap per company, it could be higher, for instance, than 25 million. But you could also require, you know, DOR, DNR, etc., in the same way as, you know, plans of development are at the moment approved before any of these developments can occur, that there is some process of vetting, also in the same way as all of the financials and the models, etc., are required to be handed over to DNR in the case of royalty modification assessments. You could see some sort of process that was very similar to some of those things that looked at the details of the financials of a project and, before anything was actually spent, approved or didn't approve.
So some kind of a front-end due diligence process there?
Absolutely.
And then if I just get really a capstone conclusion, then even if we did all that, if you're looking at this from industry's perspective, where we, the state, all of us collectively as the state, were responsible, you know, can be held responsible for the veto of the credits last year, how can industry, you know, go ahead if they, how do we give them the assurance that we won't do it again this year? Let's just say we pass a bill, we pass legislation, and we put in this due diligence process, but how can we, in any, how can, what can we as a state do that gives industry the assurance that we're not going to pull the rug out from under them with, you know, a veto after, you know, we've really, apparently as a legislature, made the commitment?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, I think the single biggest thing that can be done is committing to a regime that you can demonstrate is sustainable, and sustainable at the prices that we've seen for the future, and that the state has thought through all of the potential scenarios of what could happen and committed to say, you know, we have put these limits in place because we've thought through this problem really carefully, and we are doing this now as a once-off policy decision to create a sustainable regime for the future, rather than incrementally say, oh, we're not sure we can afford this, and so we said it might be there, but it's not really. I think that, more than anything, is both on the North Slope and on the Cook Inlet, the most important thing that can occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that thought.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I appreciate the discussion, and I definitely appreciate the idea of project sanction. When you have a project going forward, you have commitment, not when you have a lease sale, which is saying, okay, we're going to go out and explore, and we haven't gotten that level of investment. So, you know, I would just suggest that if we were talking about a time frame, as I think that you indicated, it was much harder after you'd sanctioned the project, gone out and got the investment, you know, at sanctioning, to do a project, and going forward from there, it's much more problematic. But this slide and what you stated was looking at the economic impact from a producer's standpoint. So this slide is looking at it that way, not from the standpoint of the state. And we talked about this before, of looking at it both ways. So if we look at it from the state standpoint and looking at the net present value of our investment through the 35%, et cetera, and the gross value reduction, I'm also interested in that. So, I mean, we've got the presentation coming up tomorrow based on that, and if you have anything further to add in that vein, looking at our investment by the credits, et cetera, in the early part of the project, and having a reasonable net present value calculation with a reasonable discount rate, so we can find out what is our value in the project. I think that would be very helpful, because that's not quite a mirror image, but it's a different slide than what we see here for an individual project.
Representative, if I can, I might go to a slide that, I'll apologize, is not part of your deck, but I at the last minute yesterday before coming and presenting, put in as an appendix in the presentation version that I hope is the one that I have here, precisely because I wanted to it's not a finished slide, as it were, but it's a chart that I wanted to have in case such a question came up. We haven't. There is certainly further analysis that we can do on this, but this is essentially a chart of discounted, with everyone discounted at a 10% rate, value of the same project that we were just looking at overall, to the company, to the federal government, to the state, and the left was a comparison of the old system of ACEs. The right is SB21 with a gross value reduction. Obviously, you know, under the previous system, under ACEs, you had astronomical value to the state as prices went higher. You'll see, sort of, you know, relatively speaking, things look much more similar in the sub sort of 70s, particularly sub $60 world between the two of them, and actually, because the effective rate of support for government spending has gone down from 45% to 35%, the state is actually slightly better protected on the low end than it was under the previous regime. There are, you know, in this sub-$40 environment, were that to be the case for the, and this is looking not just at the production tax rate, but the entire fiscal system, and certainly, for instance, assumes that we're talking about development in places where, in this case, assumes a 16.7% royalty rate. If that royalty rate were lower, those numbers would change, and we can do further analysis on that if you would like. But I think the point of this was to look at the question of, in terms of the total fiscal system, the total value to the state, what does that look like across a really wide range of prices? And I think what was clear to me from this chart, both now and similar exercises back in the days of SB21, was to say, you know, there is a fairly even split of value in this world between the company and the state, that the state is always better off than the company, and that I think the biggest source of worry, particularly under ACES, was when you looked at investments on an incremental basis, there were times that you could have investments that were value creating for a company and value destroying for the state, and that was deeply concerning. Here you have a system where the split is relatively even, where the value for the state is higher in all circumstances, again, subject to the assumptions I set out, than the value is for the company, and that while it can be negative for the state, that's only in sustained prices that are so low that it's much, much more value destroying for the company. And I think when I look at that overall, I see a regime that I think by and large works pretty well.
And Mr. Chairman, follow up. That I appreciate, you know, getting into this because, of course, you know, what we're having to look at is the investment of the state as well and what the full field development goes. So I'm sure you'll be here tomorrow, I think, so we can have that conversation. So if you had developed that on more than, you know, 16.7% royalty, I don't think we have in very many cases. So if we would look at that, and if you'd also look at that in the case of it being on private royalty land, so that we don't get that would be helpful to know in what circumstances we're making a good investment and what circumstances we may be making an investment that is going to be a net loss to the state. So thanks.
Representative Seddon, through the chair, to the best of my knowledge, and I will investigate this further, most GVR eligible production is on leases that are either at a 16.7% lease or a net profit share lease. I think by and large the lower royalty rates in terms of the 12.5 are very much in the legacy fields. I think the point though about places where that lease is held by an entity other than the state is a very valid one, and that certainly should be looked at further.
Please continue.
Okay. So the second point on this slide was simply to say, other than substantially increasing the capital requirement, the other big impact is, you know, you're substantially increasing, either decreasing the sort of rate of return at any given price or substantially increasing the price level at which, you know, a company in assessing their economics reaches a particular hurdle rate of return. So depending whether you take that sort of 25 million credit cap or the effective lower bound of the fact that many of the companies looking at this may also already be claiming that 25 million on other projects, it's somewhere between a sort of $5 and a $15 difference in the price range at which you meet, let's say, a 15% or a 20% internal rate of return hurdle, and that has a substantial impact on what projects are sanctioned and what projects are not. Finally, and I foreshadowed this slide yesterday in answering a question from Representative Seaton, but to come back to say, ultimately, when, you know, again, looking at this hypothetical 80 million barrel new project, when we stack together that impact of the capped credits with the more binding, harder floor at low prices, really what we're talking about is a series of changes that make a system that is overall neutral across a wide range of prices, but still heavily regressive when we get down into the below $60 a barrel world, is ultimately to make that a more aggressive system, right? So the idea here was to say, these are the different components of government take, and I need to apologize that it turns out the lower line of the legend got cut off on this. So you can see the red is the royalty, the yellow is the property tax, and again, to come back to a point that was made yesterday, both to the municipalities and to the state. The green is the production tax. There are then two items that aren't on that legend, which of course is the lighter blue / purple, which is state corporate income tax, and the bigger darker one, which is federal corporate income tax. So these are stacked together as the various components of government take, and as long as those are all positive, they add up to the dashed black line, which is the total level of government take, and a big part of the idea behind SB 21 with the gross value reduction was to say that for new investments, we were targeting a system that was really effectively neutral across a really wide range of prices at around an overall 62% government take level. Because of the regressive nature of the royalty, that still starts to change at the lowest possible prices, because the regressive royalty, even though there's no production tax at those prices, and production tax at those prices is even effectively negative. And when I say effectively negative, I don't mean that the state is always paying out money. I mean that across that cash flow cycle that we saw of the project investment, there were credits spent up front, and there is production tax at the tail, and that in those, if one were to imagine nothing but $40 a barrel for the entire life of this project, that the value of those credits would always be bigger than the value of the production tax that was generated in the later years. Versus once we're at sort of $60, $70 above, the value of the production tax is greater than that of the credits that were paid up front, and that's the difference there. But even in that world where the effective net impact of the production tax is negative, all the other components, and in particular the highly regressive nature of the royalty, means that you still have not only at least 62% government take, but that under the system as it exists at the moment, that starts to curve upward, and you know, below $50 a barrel, once you hit 40, you're getting as high as 100% government take, which is to say, even though the state is effectively contributing to the producer through the production tax, in net what it's taking for his royalty, when we look at the system overall, and it's the overall fiscal system that anyone making an investment is looking at here, the system overall is still taking all the value that there is at those lower prices. And so the impact of the changes that are made here in terms of hardening the floor and all the rest are simply really saying, well, at that sort of $40 level, rather than being 100% government take, we're going to go up to more like 150% government take. And I think thinking about things in that context should, I hope, paint a different and clearer picture than simply thinking about questions of what rate of tax is a given taxpayer paying at a different at a given price, particularly when those rates are quoted on the gross.
And thank you again, Mr. Chair. Janica, completely see where what you've done with these graphic illustrations, but just purely technoid questions. We've got four colors and three keys. What is the blue bar, the blue component of the bar?
Representative Hawkins, which I said at the outset, I needed to apologize for the fact that the lower end of the key had gotten cut off in laying this out on the slide, and that there are two items missing. There is a lighter blue and a darker blue, or shade of purple, if you will. The lighter one is state corporate income tax, and the darker is federal corporate income tax.
And I'm pretty sure it's just the, if I may continue, sir.
Please.
Pretty sure it's just the way, you know, reproduction on a paper comes out, but in that there are two non-marked bars, it seems like where I can see going across here, of course, the whole point is that production tax is positive, it reaches a point, it becomes negative and falls below the bar.
Yep.
At least on the paper as we've got it, it appears that at 60 down to like 45, I've got production tax both above and below the bar, but I'm hoping that's just a color variance. And what you're really trying to what you're showing there is the increasing relevance, the increasing significance of the state corporate income tax, and particularly the state ad valorem tax.
And even more than that, the royalty itself, right? The royalty is the big regressive element.
Thank you.
President Hawker, through the chair.
Thank you. Please continue. Representative Seaton.
Just trying to, you know, we keep trying to compare systems. So if we were looking at North Dakota and it was a 27% or 30% private royalty, or if it's on the an area of the state where we don't have the royalty to the state, then this, how does this look? I mean, and in actuality, does that change really a decision of a company who they're paying?
Representative through the chair, by and large, certainly, for instance, for the perspective of fiscal comparisons, and I think this is true as well in terms of how a company assesses an investment, right? You incorporate royalties. It's really only in the U.S. lower 48 that the royalties go to private landholders rather than to the state. Almost anywhere else in the world, royalties go to the sovereign. But in any of those cases, one effectively treats, for most purposes, the royalty as if it went to the sovereign, even though it goes to the private landholder, because ultimately they're simply a stakeholder that is not you, the company, right? It's all cash that goes to someone else, whether that's a private landholder or to the government. In terms of the comparison with North Dakota, North Dakota tends to have high fixed royalties. That absolutely means that at a given cost level, you know, at these sorts of price environments, one is bleeding even more there than one is here. The offset to that is because fixed royalties are highly regressive, when prices are better, you're also taking a lot more of the cash, right? And that comes back to the point that I made at the outset, I think, and in fact is the one I make again in this concluding slide. That's not quite true. Let's stay on the slide. Which is that in any fiscal system, it's all about balance and what the system looks like over a wide range of prices. You can be Norway and take a large share, and particularly take a large share when prices are high. You can be North Dakota and take, you know, whether it's the state or the private landholder, really protect yourself on the downside by having a very regressive high fixed royalty and give away a lot on the upside. And that's all about risk and reward, right? The high fixed royalty says we, the royalty holder, don't want commodity risk. We want as little of it as possible. And because of that, we want to push all the risk onto the private sector, but we're willing to give away a lot when times are good as a result. Profit-based taxation is about saying we don't want the distorting impacts at low prices on investment. We want to try to enable all resources that should be developed to be developed and not have our taxation system be a barrier to that. And we would like, over the course of the commodity cycle, to take more. And the net profit tax is a way that enables us to do that. And the trade-off that we make is, in doing that, we understand we're going to have more revenue volatility and that we, as a state, need to have the mechanisms in place to manage that volatility. Right? What you can't do is be both at the same time.
Follow up. And so I guess what I'm trying to, since we have both systems here in the state, either royalty or not royalty, and we're looking at government take on these figures, government take is drastically different between the two systems. So modeling that becomes quite, or the investment decision and not having any factor in there for changing investment decisions based on government take, when they're drastically different between those two kind of projects, seems that we're not making any decision. We don't have a decision point in the analysis that we've gotten. So if you can, as you go forward, prepare something for us on that, that would be appreciated.
Representative Seaton, for the chair, I will think about that and do what I can. I think ultimately I will always come back to the idea of balancing risk and reward, right? If I'm investing in Norway, I do it because I know that I'm going to have less upside when times are good, but I know that things aren't going to look truly ugly when times are bad. If I'm investing in North Dakota, I'm doing it because I know I take a lot of risk, you know, particularly when I'm first buying, or think about this in terms of the federal offshore, where I might have a huge initial cash bid for a block before I've even so much as drilled a well. Right? All of the risk in that case is on the investor. And I know that not only am I taking a huge risk when I make the big bid for the block, I haven't yet drilled a well, but if I have a discovery, I want to go through to production, I do it under this regressive fiscal regime. That means that I'm, you know, big offshore development, I'm spending billions of dollars, and when prices are low, that's going to really, 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 really hurt. But I'm doing it because I run my economics at a really wide range of prices. I know what I think is going to happen across the commodity cycle, and even if there are times that really, really hurts, there are times that I'm going to make enough on the upside that across that balance, and I'm going to do a bunch of probabilistic modeling and all the rest, that this makes sense, right? And it's always in that sense about balance of risk and reward.
And follow up. And Mr. Chairman, and I realize that, but we're again looking at it from the project or the producer's perspective. If we take a situation offshore and we apply our same fiscal terms to it, or if we take a private royalty where we don't get any royalty in it, we're making decisions and putting a lot of cash into credit systems, which we may never see any basic return from on the basis of wide price range within the $50 to $70 dollar P80 that you were talking about before. If we are expending tremendous amounts on credits and have a very conservative discount rate, we're still maybe never recovering our investment over the life of the field. And so I'm concerned about that. And so as we go forward, I want to see if our decision making needs to have a bifurcation for whether it concerns something where we have the full economic return to the state, or those projects where we don't have economic return to the state, but we have a huge liability to the state if we're extending credits into an area where we don't get a fiscal return from royalty. And so that's please just look into the in modeling if you do that. I'm not talking about investing in Norway or something. I'm talking about the two regimes that we have here within the state of Alaska.
Representative through the chair, if I understand the crux of your concern, it's really about the question of, in particular, New Orleans Senate Bill 21 and what that looks like in places where the royalty is not a state royalty but is either, for instance, a native corporation royalty or a federal royalty, and what that looks like in terms of net present value to the state across a wide range of prices. I agree that is an important concern to have, and we can certainly do analysis on that.
Thank you.
Representative Pocker, did you have a comment?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, when I was sensing, and even myself, I was having a hard time following the question. I just was getting ready to volunteer that I think that what you were really getting to is the significant distinction in the state between private royalty interest, which is privately owned land, mm-hmm. as opposed to state land, mm-hmm. and our production tax credit system provides this whole systemic structure across the entire spectrum. And we even take a look, and I'll compound the problem a little further. We have an entirely separate production tax structure for private royalty interests in statute. It's not subject to the same production. We talk about, we've got an entirely separate levy for oil produced on, land, for the separate landowner, which is 5% of the gross value at point of production. And, that's our entire sum total royalty, or pardon me, sum total production tax.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To conclude, come back to the sort of summary that we started with simply, which is to say that while the bill isn't a tax overhaul, it includes a series of major changes along, things that appear possibly minor at first, that when you think through the impacts are actually quite major. That there are some absolutely legitimate concerns that we've just discussed. Questions of should the potential liability from credits be capped? If so, at what level and how should that be applied going forward? What's the role of the gross floor? How do you balance protecting the state on the downside versus the upside that the state takes by having a net tax-based system? But there's also a lot of incremental revenue-raising measures, which, on the one hand, in a time of strained finances, one understands. On the other hand, from an investor's perspective, get very scary very quickly. And I think more than anything else, one looks at all of those things, whether that be going from annual to monthly on the way certain tax elements of the tax system are calculated, or a series of those things, and sees ultimately a series of things that are not necessarily big picture questions about the sustainability of the system and whether there are areas that need further reform that might be done as a once-off, well-thought-through piece, but rather incremental revenue raising. And I think when you look at this from an investor perspective, those sorts of things are quite chilling, because big picture reforms that are about the question of is this sustainable or not, one might not like the impact of, but if they're put in place well, one can understand and one can live with, and particularly if one sees them as a once-off change. The scariest thing for any investor is when you start to feel like every year the sovereign's going to be coming back and seeking to take a bit more here and a bit more there. And I think that, more than anything else, is what concerns us most when we look at this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Janik, I appreciate the summary page and, of course, all the graphics before it, But I guess I'd like there's several points that can be covered, but I would ask that so I can think about this tonight is three examples, and one is a good one that you like about the proposed legislation, one that's bad and we should not consider it, and the third one would be ugly, and that ugly meaning that it's not good, it's not bad, but it's something that needs a lot of work.
Representative Herron, I could give you an answer now if you want, which is...
Please.
On the good side, I would say, while it needs to be very carefully thought through in terms of how it's implemented, I think that the intention behind Senate Bill 21 was to say everyone gets 35% support for government spending, not, in some cases, substantially higher because of the interplay of the GVR. I think one needs to be very careful about how that's implemented, but from a point of policy, I think it's wise to find a way to address in a way that doesn't disadvantage people who've made investment decisions, assuming that to be the case. On the bad side, I would say the things that are easy to see solely as incremental revenue raising measures, rather than thought through pieces of policy, are chilling from an investor perspective. On the ugly side, I would say anything to do with the floor. Right. I understand that protecting the state in low prices is always going to be a key consideration, but that balance between protecting the state on the low side versus what the state takes on the high side, and the inability to be both Norway and North Dakota, I think is a key challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And thank you, Janet. Without apologies, I'd like to return back to that private royalty interest conversation quickly for a capstone comment. And the question raised had to do, went to basically all the 023 and the 025 credits that are available for a producer working on state-owned lands, and whether or not those benefits would be just extraordinary and completely distort the fact that we'd never get a recovery back on the private royalty interest royalties, which are by statute 4355011I, fixed 5%. I'd also note that the 02, and I'll stand corrected if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that all of the 023 and all of the 025 credits are specifically restricted to activities that are in fact conducted on state and federal lands and are specifically not applicable to private royalty interests. And I'm not asking you, that was a comment, sir.
Representative Cheatham?
Mr. Chairman, this is a discussion to find out whether we have liabilities or not. This isn't an argument in any
sense. No, not in the least.
So. But I appreciate the comment.
Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, can we go back to slide 13 for a minute, please? So Representative Hockover had brought up some questions the way OPEX and CAPEX were just averaged here over these months. And so I was just trying to do some numbers while sitting here. And just trying to think through different scenarios. So, maybe it'd be easier if you even just prepared some of these different scenarios. But for example, like on the CapEx side, if you had one of the majors that wasn't doing a lot of extra, capital work up on the North Slope, if just that in itself changes, I mean, that does, just running some quick numbers, have a pretty dramatic impact on the way the production tax would work out. And so I guess it would be interesting, just to see, instead of having that, because if they're going to do it on the monthly basis, then it could have a real impact, depending on the fluctuation from month to month. So if you could prepare a little bit of that just shows even some modest fluctuation in that. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to envision different scenarios than what you're suggesting here.
Representative Septar, we can certainly do some analysis. I've always been in the fortunate position in providing analysis and all these things and being able to look solid at an annual level and provide high-level advice without having to get into the detail level of the actual process of filing tax returns and those sorts of things that companies have to get into. This is clearly something that requires getting into those weeds, and we're very happy to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that concludes the presentation on the North Slope assessment, in which case, if there's no further questions on that, we will switch over to the Cook Inlet one.
That's a big difference.
I want to have a brief at ease.
She's just got other stuff.
Thanks for the brief break, and we'll continue. Please continue, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. To proceed with our sort of assessment of House Bill 247 in terms of the impact on the Cook Inlet. To start with a high-level summary, and then we'll drill down into all of these things in a lot more detail. We want to sort of start with going through a series of slides on some of the history of what's actually happened to oil and gas production activity in the Cook Inlet in recent years. There's a lot of talk about, you know, the turnaround and the role of credits and prices and other things in that turnaround. Sometimes that discussion can happen in a little bit of a data vacuum, and we thought it was important to bring as much data to bear on the analysis as possible, so we've tried to use both the plethora of data that AOGCC and others make available to try to paint the picture of what's actually happened looking back in the past. Essentially what's happened is, you know, oil production has risen substantially. It was as low as 7,500 barrels a day in 2009. It's now as high as 18,000 barrels, so you've really seen that substantial turnaround on the oil front. Gas production, you haven't seen that turnaround, but you've seen a sort of stabilization after years of steady decline. And in many ways, one could say that gas production hasn't seen the same degree of turnaround because it's a restricted domestic market where you're limited to the demand that's available. More broadly than that, the Cook Inlet gas market has seen a sort of major adjustment in recent years, right? It's gone through the sort of huge transition both in terms of factors on the supply side, the demand side, pricing and the pricing regime that occurs, competition between various players, expectations. It's a major transformation in how the system works. Some of these sorts of changes are things that we see in all mature basins around the world. Some of them are specific to Cook Inlet, and we're going to drill down into the nature of some of those things in the slide deck as we go through it. And finally, we're going to finish up looking at, you know, what's the outlook for Cook Inlet and how sensitive is it to changes in the oil and gas fiscal system. Department of Natural Resources has prepared various studies. One they put out in the second half of last year, I think there are some updated numbers this year to look at the addition of where potential resources at Blue Crest's Cosmopolitan field or Fury's Kitchen Lights. Added to that, what would that look like? They estimate just under sort of 1.2 TCF of remaining 2P reserves based solely on the existing mature producing fields, and an additional sort of 400 BCF or so from Cosmopolitan and Kitchen Lights. That's an estimate that's certainly much lower than might be implied by some of the statements made by the operators of those fields. Clearly it's intentionally a conservative one. But they estimate in total 1.6 TCF of gas in the ground that could come to market with sufficient ongoing drilling, as well as development at Cosmopolitan and Kitchen Lights. So if you saw in particular development at those two fields, I think you can say that the current market would be well supplied, particularly for the next decade plus, at least. And that's, of course, subject to two big provisos that we want to talk about more, which is the pace of ongoing drilling and development and what it might require to develop those sorts of resources that are not currently developed, and what the role of the credits in all that is and what impacts that can have. Broadly speaking, I think we would say that at the sorts of prices that now exist in the Cook Inlet, that brownfield investment in terms of, in particular, drilling new wells in mature producing fields is pretty economic even under a system that has substantially less credits. When it comes to developing new resources, particularly new resources that require major facilities to be built as part of that, those economics look very different. And potentially credits have a strong role to play there, particularly when you look at the difficult constraints that limited demand places on what those developments might look like. And so we want to go through some of our modelling around that as to why we reach those conclusions. More than that, we would say that clearly at the moment there is a lot of uncertainty around the future of the fiscal regime. That uncertainty exists for numerous reasons. It exists for the fact that the regime as it's legislated expires in the early part of the next decade, that there is a sort of envisioned review process between now and then to look at what the future would be, and then it's been made obviously more uncertain by the question of the line item veto last year, by the question of, you know, anyone, even without that, looking at the sheer numbers of credits and outflow that occurs at the moment, would have to question what the sustainability of that system is. And when you question what the sustainability of that system is, from an investor's perspective, you start to get worried as to whether this might exist at the moment, but will it continue to exist in the future? And when one looks at the regime that exists on paper, is it actually going to be the one that exists when it comes crunch time? And so, more than anything else, I think we would say, in terms of enabling future investment, certainly there are places where credits are important, there are places where they are less so, but that more than anything else, a long-term, stable, sustainable system, one that is well thought through, is ultimately going to be paramount to seeing ongoing long-term investment in the Cook Inlet.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Mayor, it almost sounded like you were saying that investors in Cook Inlet could say to themselves, this system is so generous, we question ourselves whether it's sustainable. That's almost how I hear what you said.
Representative Joseph, and through the chair, I think when you look at the sheer amount of credit outflows, they were one thing at a time when the state was bringing in billions of dollars of revenue through the production tax system, and you know, it was very easy to say there are serious problems when it comes to the future of South Central gas supply. There's a lot of money coming in through North Slope taxes. The state can certainly afford to incentivize some of this to spur activity that it wants to see spurred at a time when there is much less revenue coming in from the North Slope, when, to skip ahead simply two slides, we'll come to this in 5 seconds anyway, when, you know, the picture between the North Slope system and the Cook Inlet system and the sheer amount of credit outflow that we looked at yesterday, I think anyone looks at those numbers of $400 million plus in 2015 spent on Cook Inlet credits and says it's unclear, you know, in a constrained budget environment how long that can go on for.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative
Von Tallarico. So, Mr. Mayor, I guess, too, reading between the lines, are you telling us that the clock is ticking and that if we'll be far better off if we focus on this and start to structure something long before we get to the midnight hour and it disappears and we would end up making, you don't make good decisions in a panic is my kind of my estimation on that. So it's probably a good idea to start to begin a focus on what we will do when that expires and get that well out in front so that we can, everyone's aware of the system that will be in place.
Representative Taylor, yes, I would agree. I know that there are a lot of factors that make that a very difficult discussion to have and probably orders of magnitude more difficult this year than in subsequent times. But I would say that whatever is done with the Cook Inlet fiscal system, and this comes back to comments I've made previously, for instance, about some of the effective dates in this bill, right? Changes that impact July 1st this year potentially have very difficult impacts, right? There are already drilling programs that have been committed to, that have been committed to relying on some of the credits that exist, and I think at least some of those concern developments that one would really like to see happen for pressing interests of the state. Beyond that time frame, I think that everyone understands that it's really hard to look at those numbers and see this as a sustainable system, and that if you don't see this as a sustainable system, it's really hard to make investment decisions unless you run a range of worst-case scenarios and make them more on the worst-case scenarios than on the actual existing statute scenario. And in that sense, the sooner one can conduct a really reasoned effort into saying not just, well, what happens if we sort of scratch a credit here or two, but what should the fiscal system for Cook Inlet be to be both sustainable and stable for the future and strike the right balance between incentivizing the sorts of activity that the state wants to see incentivizing while doing so in a sustainable way. I think that is a conversation that needs to start as soon as it can. to quickly go through two slides that we showed yesterday, simply in framing the issue. Obviously, all of this discussion comes from the fact that credits have grown substantially, and when we look at FY 2015, you know, the bulk of them are actually being spent in the Cook Inlet, despite the fact, as you can see on the next slide, that Cook Inlet brings in, at least at the moment, a bare fraction of the revenues of the North Slope, and always will do. Okay, it's a snapshot at a point in time. Some of those credits may produce additional revenue in the future, but the balance is clearly off in a way that, as I say, is difficult to see as sustainable. I should note one error on this slide. We will provide a corrected version, which is simply to say that I think, as I hope is obvious, there should, of course, be a negative bar on the left-hand side, right, which is the left-hand side is the total, and obviously there is a negative component there, which is the credit outflows, which is simply the sum of the negative bars on the right side, which is the 224 on the North Slope and the 404 for the Cook Inlet. So there's sort of $628 million in credit outflow, which simply seems to have been cut off on the chart. Okay, to try to go through relatively quickly, because I know we're constrained for time, some of our slides on sort of basic overview of the history of the Cook Inlet. Clearly there have been a number of major things that have occurred between a period around 2010 or so where there was real concern about the future of gas supply in the Cook Inlet, the future of overall activity in terms of the oil and gas industry as an economic basis for that part of the world. And key parts of those changes have been about pricing, about storage, and about credits. And in the presence of all those changes, one has seen substantial response, right? The chart here on the left is about exploratory wells that were spudded, and the number in the year that happened. The green bars are the actual number of wells. The red is the three-year rolling average. The right-hand side is looking not at the exploration picture, but at actual producing wells in the year in which they first came online. And in both of those, you see, obviously, a substantial uptick in activity in the Cook Inlet in this period, and particularly when you're looking at producing wells in the year in which they came online. I mean, activity at the moment, you look at that three-year rolling average, and it's back up to the level that you saw briefly in the middle of the last decade, and otherwise the only other time you've seen that level of activity is back in the 1970s. And I think that is quite striking. And it's important to say that all of the things that have happened have had a substantial impact on activity in the basin. When we look at overall oil and gas production, it's first of all very important to separate the two, because what we've seen happen is quite different between those. Oil, of course, you know, started shortly after 1960, peaked in 1970 at fully 226,000 barrels a day, fell to a trough of just 7,500 barrels a day in 2009, and you've seen, and so the chart on the left is oil production, you've seen a substantial upturn in that period. We were back up to, you know, about 18,000 barrels a day. It's more than double what it was just down in 2009. It's been really, really a remarkable turnaround. Gas production hasn't seen that turnaround, but it has seen a stabilization. The chart on the right shows both gross production being effective. This is all sort of data that comes from ANGCC that we've done analysis on. So gross production being what is metered effectively at the wellhead. Then you have the question of what was actually sold versus what was reinjected back into the field, and so we look at that in the yellow bar, sorry, in the green bar, and then the yellow or orange is the net result, and by separating things out that way, it's quite striking, right? Because gross gas, you know, peaked as early as 1990, right? And so in terms of the actual gas coming out of the fields, peaked in 1990 and started declining pretty precipitously. So you had this big drop in 94 to 98. But from the perspective of net production, a plateau from that point onwards, or at least a plateau throughout the 1990s, really. And that's a function of one thing and one thing alone, which is Swanson River, the oil field that in many ways enabled the founding of Alaska as a state to occur. A lot of associated gas, that was all gas that was being reinjected for many years, and basically when you look at that reinjection line is all Swanson River. That turned around in the 90s, where that gas can now start to be produced, and it's the start of the production of that gas and the steady decrease in reinjection that meant you had, instead of a crisis in the mid-1990s, actually an ongoing plateau where you had stable production really like all the way through to 2005, and then it's only up after 2005 when that temporary plateau that came from the production of, and sale of gas from Swanson River, that you then started to see the declines in gas production.
Representative Olson.
During that period, the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of flaring going on both onshore and offshore. Is that something they would keep track of? Or
Representative Olson, for the chair, I'd have to go back and look at the numbers to see how that's counted for. I know my colleague Nikos is on the line. I don't know if he has anything further to contribute on how flaring is treated historically in the data. Nick, you're very difficult to hear and breaking up here, so we might try again at some point in the future to see if you can contribute.
Well, something you can get back to me on. I'm just curious because at night you could...
Sorry, can I...
Oh, that's better.
Much clearer.
Oh, sorry about that. I'm trying out a new system. I said that the Nikos Tsafos, for the record, president of Analytica, I'm not quite sure about how the flaring shows up. There, we have essentially two databases that the AOGC puts up there on, you know, well production and then well reinjection or well injection. And I'm not sure if the production of the well, I'm pretty sure it's gross, so it doesn't really take into account whether it's marketed or whether it's used at the field or anything else. It's just really gross. So there may be gas that doesn't quite find its way to the market either because of flaring, venting, or just use of the field. So this isn't necessarily gas that, you know, shows up in the final market.
Thank you very much.
Proceed.
Thank you.
Okay, to move on to the next slide, just slide number 7. So when we look specifically at the turnaround that's happened in oil, what you can see is that it's a function both of new wells, but in particular a lot of workover activity. So we've sort of split that out here. On the left-hand chart, what you see is production by well vintage. So each colored line represents production from a well that came online in a particular decade, right? So the green line, for instance, is wells that were brought online, production from wells that were brought online between 1991 and 2000. The red line, pre-1970. Get the picture, right? So you see a couple of things. One, there's a really, really striking turnaround in that green line. That green line comes down in about 2009 to be only about 2,000 barrels a day, and then, you know, by now is back up to over 4,000 barrels a day. So that's saying that the wells that came online in the 1990s are now producing twice what they produced back in 2009. So that's not new drilling that's occurred, that's substantial work that's done to make those existing wells much, much more productive. Workover activity.
I think at the time we got, we're running out of time, so we will come back tomorrow. Thank you, Janek and Analytica, for being available today. Our next committee meeting is tomorrow at 10 o'clock a.m., and Analytica and Director Ken Alper will be presenting. Is there any further business before the committee? If not, we adjourn at 2 o'clock p.m.